Chapter 9. The Atkins Onslaught. The Carbohydrate Insulin Hypothesis. As we've now established that insulin causes obesity, our next question is, what foods causes our insulin levels to rise or to spike? The most obvious candidate is the refined carbohydrate, highly refined grains and sugars. This brings us not to a new idea, but back to a very old idea that predates even William Banting, the idea that fattening carbohydrates caused obesity. Highly refined carbohydrates are the most notorious foods for raising blood sugars. High blood sugars lead to high insulin levels. High insulin levels lead to weight gain and obesity. This chain of causes and effects has become known as the carbohydrate insulin hypothesis. The man who found himself at the center of the controversy was the infamous Dr. Robert Atkins. In 1963, Dr. Robert Atkins was a fat man. Like William Banting 100 years before, he needed to do something. Weighing in at 224 pounds, 100 kilograms, he had recently begun his cardiology practice in New York City. He had tried the conventional ways to lose weight, but had met with no success. Recalling the medical literature published by doctors Pennington and Gordon on low-carbohydrate diets, he decided to try the low-carbohydrate approach himself. To his amazement, it worked as advertised. Without counting calories, he shed his bothersome extra weight. He started prescribing the low-carbohydrate diet to patients and had some notable success. In 1965, he appeared on The Tonight Show, and in 1970, was featured in Vogue. In 1972, he published his original book, Dr. Atkins' Diet Revolution. It was an immediate bestseller and one of the fastest-selling diet books in history. The Low-Carb Revolution. Dr. Atkins never claimed to have invented the low-carb diet. That approach had been around long before the formerly popular diet doctor wrote about it. Jean-Anthelme Brillat-Savarin wrote about carbohydrates and obesity in 1825. William Banting described the same relationship in his best-selling pamphlet, Letter on Corpulence, in 1863. These ideas have endured for close to two centuries. However, by the mid-1950s, the caloric reduction theory of obesity was gaining ascendancy. It seemed so much more scientific to be discussing calories rather than foods. But there were still holdouts. Dr. Alfred Pennington wrote an editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1953, emphasizing the role of carbohydrates in obesity. Studies by Dr. Walter Bloom comparing low-carbohydrate diets to fasting regimens had found comparable weight loss between the two. Dr. Erwin Stillman wrote The Doctor's Quick Weight Loss Diet in 1967, recommending a high-protein, low-carbohydrate diet. It quickly sold more than 2.5 million copies. Since it takes extra energy to metabolize dietary protein, the thermogenic effect of food, eating more protein could theoretically cause more weight loss. Dr. Stillman himself lost 50 pounds following the Stillman diet, which contained up to 90% protein. He reportedly used the diet to treat more than 10,000 overweight patients. By the time Dr. Atkins joined the fray, the low-carbohydrate revolution was already well underway. Dr. Atkins argued in his 1972 bestseller that severely restricting carbohydrates would keep insulin levels low, thus reducing hunger and eventually leading to weight loss. It didn't take long for the nutritional authorities to respond. In 1973, the American Medical Association's Council on Foods and Nutrition published a blistering attack on Atkins' ideas. Most physicians at that time worried that the high fat content of the diet would lead to heart attacks and strokes. Nonetheless, low-carb proponents continued to preach. In 1983, Dr. Richard Bernstein, himself a type 1 diabetic since age 9, opened a controversial clinic to treat diabetics with a strict low-carbohydrate diet, a method that directly contradicted most nutritional and medical teachings of the time. In 1997, Bernstein published Dr. Bernstein's Diabetes Solution. In 1992, and then again in 1999, Atkins updated his bestseller with the publication of Dr. Atkins' New Diet Revolution. Bernstein's and Atkins' books would become monster bestsellers, with more than 10 million copies sold. In 1993, scientists Rachel and Richard Heller wrote The Carbohydrate Addict's Diet, which sold more than 6 million copies. The Atkins onslaught had well and truly begun. The low-carb diet's popularity, rekindled in the 1990s, ignited into a full-scale inferno in 2002, when award-winning journalist Gary Taubes wrote a controversial lead article in the New York Times entitled, "What If It's All Been a Big Fat Lie?" He argued that dietary fat, long believed to cause atherosclerosis, was actually quite harmless to human health. He followed that up with the best-selling books Good Calories, Bad Calories, and Why We Get Fat, in which he expounded on the idea that carbohydrates were the root cause of weight gain. The Empire Strikes Back. These ideas were slow to take hold in the medical community. Many physicians still felt that low-carb was simply the latest in a long line of failed dietary fads. The American Heart Association, AHA, published its own book called the No-Fad Diet, a personal plan for healthy weight loss. It's only mildly ironic that while condemning other diets, the AHA would recommend the only diet, low-fat, repeatedly proven to fail. But the low-fat religion was enshrined in the medical community, and it did not tolerate disbelievers. Despite a stunning lack of evidence to support this low-fat advice, medical associations such as the AHA and the American Medical Association were quick to defend their beliefs and denounce these new fad diets. But the Atkins onslaught was relentless. In 2004, more than 26 million Americans claimed to be on some type of low-carbohydrate diet. Even fast food chains introduced low-carb lettuce-wrapped burgers. The possibility of permanently reducing excess weight and all its associated health complications seemed within grasp. The AHA admitted that the reduced-fat diet was unproven over the long term. It also conceded that the Atkins diet evidenced a superior cholesterol profile and yielded a more rapid initial weight loss. Despite these benefits, the AHA maintained its concerns with atherogenicity, the rate at which plaques would form in the arteries. There was, of course, no evidence to support this concern. Regarding its own recommended but scientifically unsupported low-fat diet, the AHA had no concerns at all. No concern that higher intake of sugar and other refined carbohydrates could be harmful. No concern that the low-fat diet had been proved a spectacular failure by every dietary study done. No concern that the obesity and diabetes epidemics were raging full force under their very noses. The AHA fiddled while Rome burned. During the 40 years that the AHA advised the low-fat diet, the obesity crisis grew to gargantuan proportions. Yet at no time did the AHA question whether their completely ineffectual advice was actually helping people. Instead, doctors played their favorite game: blame the patient. "It is not our fault the diet doesn't work. It is their fault for not following the diet." Low-carb diets, a stunned medical community. As the new competitor challenged conventional dietary wisdom, the campaign of slurs and innuendo began. Nonetheless, new studies started appearing by the mid-2000s comparing the new low-carb diets to the old standards. The results would shock many, myself included. The first study, published in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine in 2003, confirmed greater short-term weight loss with the Atkins diet. In 2007, the Journal of the American Medical Association published a more detailed study. Four different popular weight plans were compared in a head-to-head trial. One clear winner emerged: the Atkins diet. The other three diets, Ornish, which has very low fat, the zone, which balances protein, carbohydrates, and fat in a 30-40-30 ratio, and a standard low-fat diet, were fairly similar with regard to weight loss. However, in comparing the Atkins to the Ornish, it became clear that not only was weight loss better, but so was the entire metabolic profile. Blood pressure, cholesterol, and blood sugars all improved to a greater extent on Dr. Atkins' diet. In 2008, the DIRECT Dietary Intervention Randomized Controlled Trial study reaffirmed once again the superior short-term weight reduction of the Atkins diet. Done in Israel, it compared the Mediterranean, the low-fat, and the Atkins diets. While the Mediterranean diet held its own against the powerful, fat-reducing Atkins diet, the low-fat AHA standard was left choking in the dust, sad, tired, and unloved, except by academic physicians. More importantly, the metabolic benefits of both the Atkins and Mediterranean diets were confirmed. The Atkins diet reduced average blood sugar levels by 0.9%, far more than other diets, and almost as powerful as most medications. The high-protein, low-glycemic index diet maintained weight loss better than the low-fat diet over 6 months. Part of the reason may be that different weight loss diets provoke different changes in total energy expenditure. Dr. David Ludwig from Harvard University found that the low-fat diet slowed body metabolism the most. What was the best diet for maintaining metabolism? The very low carbohydrate diet. This diet also seemed to reduce appetite. Dr. G. Bowden wrote in the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2005, "When we took away the carbohydrates, the patients spontaneously reduced their daily energy consumption by 1,000 calories a day. Insulin levels dropped and insulin sensitivity was restored." Perhaps eating refined carbohydrates leads to food addictions. Natural satiety signals are hormones that are extremely powerful deterrents to overeating. Hormones such as cholecystokinin and peptide YY respond to ingested proteins and fats to signal us to stop eating. Now, let's return to that all-you-can-eat buffet mentioned in Chapter 5. At some point, you simply cannot eat anymore, and the idea of consuming two more pork chops is sickening. That feeling is your satiety hormones telling you that you've had enough. But what if you were offered a small slice of cake or apple pie? Doesn't seem so hard to eat now, does it? As kids, we used to call this the second stomach phenomenon. After the first stomach for regular food was full, we imagined there was a second one for desserts. Somehow, despite being full, we still have room for highly refined carbohydrates like cake and pie, but not proteins or fats. Highly refined and processed foods somehow do not trigger the release of satiety hormones, and we go ahead and eat that cake. Think about foods that people say they're addicted to. Pasta, bread, cookies, chocolate, chips. Notice anything? All are highly refined carbohydrates. Does anybody ever say they are addicted to fish? Apples? Beef? Spinach? Not likely. Those are all delicious foods, but not addictive. Consider some typical comfort foods: macaroni and cheese, pasta, ice cream, apple pie, mashed potatoes, pancakes. Notice anything? All are highly refined carbohydrates. There is evidence that these foods activate the reward systems in our brains, which gives us comfort. Refined carbohydrates are easy to become addicted to and overeat precisely because there are no natural satiety hormones for refined carbs. The reason, of course, is that refined carbohydrates are not natural foods, but are instead highly processed. Their toxicity lies in that processing. The Atkins Decline. The studies mentioned previously left the medical profession stunned and a little bit flabbergasted. Each had been undertaken almost with the express purpose of destroying the Atkins reputation. They came to bury the Atkins diet, but instead had crowned it. One by one, the concerns of the low-carb movement were put to rest. The new diet revolution was on pace. Long live the revolution! But trouble was on the horizon. Longer-term studies of the Atkins diet failed to confirm the much-hoped-for benefits. Dr. Gary Foster from Temple University published 2-year results showing that both the low-fat and the Atkins groups had lost but then regained weight at virtually the same rate. After 12 months, all the direct study patients, including the Atkins group, regained much of the weight they'd lost. A systematic review of all the dietary trials showed that much of the benefits of a low-carbohydrate approach evaporated after 1 year. Greater compliance was supposed to be one of the main benefits of the Atkins approach, since there was no need for calorie counting. However, following the severe food restrictions of Atkins proved no easier for dieters than conventional calorie counting. Compliance was equally low in both groups, with upwards of 40% abandoning the diet within 1 year. In hindsight, this outcome was somewhat predictable. The Atkins diet severely restricted highly indulgent foods such as cakes, cookies, ice cream, and other desserts. These foods are clearly fattening, no matter what diet you believe in. We continue to eat them simply because they are indulgent. Food is a celebration, and feasting has accompanied celebration throughout human history. This is as true in year 2015 AD as it was in year 2015 BC. Birthdays, weddings, and holiday celebrations. What do we eat? Cake, ice cream, pie. Not whey powder shakes and lean pork. Why? Because we want to indulge. The Atkins diet does not allow for this simple fact, and that doomed it to failure. The first-hand experience of many people confirmed that the Atkins diet was not a lasting one. Millions of people abandoned the Atkins approach, and the new diet revolution faded into just another dietary fad. The company Atkins Nutritionals, founded in 1989 by Dr. Atkins, filed for bankruptcy, having sustained heavy losses as its customers fled. The weight loss benefits could not be sustained. But why? What happened? One of the founding principles of the low-carbohydrate approach is that dietary carbohydrates increase blood sugars the most. High blood sugars lead to high insulin. High insulin is the key driver of obesity. Those facts seem reasonable enough. What was wrong? The carbohydrate insulin hypothesis was incomplete. The carbohydrate insulin hypothesis, the idea that carbohydrates cause weight gain because of insulin secretion, was not exactly wrong. Carbohydrate-rich foods certainly do increase insulin levels to a greater extent than the other macronutrients. High insulin certainly does lead to obesity. However, the hypothesis stands incomplete. There are many problems with the paradox of the Asian rice eater being the most obvious. Most Asians, for at least the last half century, ate a diet based on white, polished rice, a highly refined carbohydrate. Yet, until recently, obesity remained quite rare in these populations. The International Study of Macronutrients and Blood Pressure, INTERMAP, compared the diets of the US, UK, China, and Japan in detail. See figure 9.1. This study was done in the late 1990s before globalization westernized the Asian diet. Total and percentage carbohydrate intake in China far exceeds the other nations. Sugar intake in China, however, is extremely low compared to the other nations. Japan's carbohydrate intake is similar to that of the UK and the US, but its sugar consumption is far lower. Despite high carbohydrate intakes, obesity rates in China and Japan stayed very low until recently. So, the carbohydrate insulin hypothesis was not incorrect, but clearly something else was going on. Total carbohydrate intake was not the entire story. Sugar seemed to be contributing much more to obesity than other refined carbohydrates. Indeed, many primitive societies that eat mostly carbohydrates have very low obesity rates. In 1989, Dr. Staffan Lindberg studied the residents of Kitawa, one of the Trobriand Islands in Papua New Guinea's archipelago, one of the last places on Earth where people ate a largely traditional diet. Starchy vegetables, including yam, sweet potato, taro, and cassava, made up the basis of their diet. An estimated 69% of calories were derived from carbohydrates, and less than 1% of the calories came from processed Western foods. Despite this high carbohydrate intake, insulin was very low among the Kitavans, resulting in virtually no obesity. Comparing the Kitavans to his native Swedish population, Dr. Lindberg found that despite a diet that was 70% carbohydrate, unrefined, the Kitavans had insulin levels below the 5th percentile of the Swedes. The average Kitavan native had an insulin level lower than 95% of Swedes. The body mass index of young Kitavans averaged 22, normal, and it decreased with age. The possibility that increased exercise led to low insulin levels and less obesity was investigated, but this turned out not to be the case. Similarly, natives of the Japanese island of Okinawa eat a diet that is nearly 85% unrefined carbohydrates. The dietary staple is sweet potato. They eat three times as many green and yellow vegetables, but only 25% of the sugar consumed by residents of nearby Japan. Despite the high intake of carbohydrates, there is virtually no obesity, and the average body mass index is only 20.4. They are one of the longest-lived peoples in the world, with more than triple the rate, compared to nearby Japan, of people living past 100 years. Clearly, the carbohydrate-insulin hypothesis is an incomplete theory, leading many to abandon it rather than to try to reconcile it with the known facts. One possibility is that there is an important difference in eating rice versus wheat. Asians tend to eat rice, whereas Western societies tend to take their carbohydrates as refined wheat and corn products. It is also possible that changes in Western obesity rates are related to changes in the variety of wheat we are eating. Dr. William Davis, author of Wheat Belly, a New York Times bestseller, suggests that the dwarf wheat that we eat today may be far different from the original wheat. The einkorn variety of wheat has been cultivated since 3300 BC. By the 1960s, as the world's population grew larger, agricultural techniques aimed at increasing the yield of the wheat led to new varieties of wheat called dwarf and semi-dwarf wheat. Currently, 99% of commercially grown wheat is dwarf and semi-dwarf varieties, and it may be that there are health implications of eating these new varieties of wheat. Insulin and obesity are still causally linked. However, it is not at all clear that high carbohydrate intake is always the primary cause of high insulin levels. In Kitawa, high carbohydrate intake did not lead to elevated insulin. The notion that carbohydrates are the only driver of insulin is incorrect. A critical piece of the puzzle had been neglected. Specifically, sugar plays a crucial role in obesity, but how does it fit in? The missing link was insulin resistance.